IL Women Podcast, the source of her sport.
Thank you for coming back to the IL Women Podcast. I am Terry Foy, joined once again by Hallie Quillenin. And Hallie, we are live on March 1st. February lacrosse is over. Can you believe it?
No, I mean, I can't even believe the 2017 season has begun, let alone we are 1 month down and only a few months removed from Memorial Day weekend.
Well, not only that, but we are coming off of a game that, you know, is likely going to be the game of the year or among the games of the year at any point in the season when it's played. Used to be an ACC matchup. Now it's a interconference ACC Big Ten matchup. But more importantly, it was a repeat of the 2016 National Championship game. This time, the Maryland Terrapins came away with a victory, 13-10 over the North Carolina Tar Heels. This was a game, number one, that you were at, but that meant that there was a little bit more with respect to some of the developments of the day, shall we say. So first things first, what do you attribute the Terps' victory to?
I think a few things. One, Maryland just came out on fire. I don't think any team in the country could have matched Maryland's energy the way they came out of the gate on Saturday. After a two and a half hour delay in the locker room, you really have to credit the Maryland staff for keeping this team loose and, you know, ready to come out and attack. I think what was really neat about Maryland is, you know, they are usually business as usual. You know, when they score a goal, there's not too much of a celebration. But every play on the field, whether it was a cause turnover, a draw control, a ground ball, the bench was going crazy. The stadium was going crazy. You know, I think what was so impressive was, despite the weather delay, they broke an attendance record. There was over 3,000 people at that game. I thought the atmosphere really played into the way that the Terps played on Saturday.
Led by Jen Giles, Zoe Sukenberg, with three goals, the Terps, like you said, were able to get out to a hot start and take a three-goal halftime lead and play even through the second half to hold on to a 13-10 victory. I'm interested in your perspective here on the atmosphere because you mentioned, obviously, the weather delay, which I think has numerous impacts, certainly on the atmosphere and also on the play on the field. But in addition to that, this game was played in Maryland Stadium after the men's game. In addition to that, it was played before a Maryland men's basketball game as well. So, what was the vibe like in the stadium? What was the vibe like in the venue? As you know, you guys are dealing with multiple delays. Not sure when the game's gonna face off or the first whistle's gonna blow. And then obviously also realizing that there's a lot of other stuff going on campus.
You know, it was when we got down to College Park, Jackie Borowski and I arrived and what looked like with 2.5 minutes on the clock in the men's game. But then that 2.5 minutes didn't really start ticking for a little while. And then the Maryland-Yale game resumed and then stopped with just over 30 seconds left on the clock with a subsequent hour plus delay. You know, I think when you are going into any game and you think your start time is at 3 o'clock and it gets pushed back. It's kind of a mental battle to keep yourself ready, to keep yourself fresh. Now add in the fact that this is a rematch of the national championship game. This is Maryland, North Carolina. This is the biggest rivalry in women's college lacrosse. And this is a team that's coming to your home turf and they beat you last year. They were the one loss on your schedule. So I think, you know, starting with Maryland, the way that they came out of the whistle and just attacked every play, you really credit how the staff, how the players, how the leaders on this team kept everyone loose in the locker room. And then, you know, you look at North Carolina, they did come out a little flat. It was uncharacteristic. I thought the one word to really characterize the way that North Carolina played on Saturday was uncharacteristic. They fouled more than they did. Their shot percentage wasn't quite where it always is. You know, I think that they were slower to the 50-50 balls than Maryland was. You can attribute that to the delay. You know, they are sitting in a locker room for 2 hours, a visitor locker room ready to go. I don't know if mentally kind of gotten their heads a little bit or just sitting around, you know, your muscles, your body, trying to keep yourself loose. I think that that could have a lot to do with it. You know, once the game started, the atmosphere itself, I love that stadium. You know, I wish that they played all of their games in that stadium. In fact, we were doing a shoot at Under Armour with Taylor Cummings earlier this week, and she said the same thing. She said that she would beg her coaches every year to at least play one game there, but she never played a game there in her college career. I think it was a neat atmosphere that it was a doubleheader after their men, watching their men come away with a close victory in the last seconds versus a very talented Yale team that could have picked them up a little bit more. I liked just the overall atmosphere of Maryland pride that day. I mean, you looked in the stands and you could just hear after every big play, Maryland fans came out in full force for this game.
So there's a new number one in the Cascade Women's Media Poll, but that was not the only shakeup in the top five. As we talked about last week, there was another top four matchup, this time with the Florida Gators separating and pulling away from the USC Women of Troy, winning 15-10. Hallie, this was a highly contested game in Gainesville, one that was very heavily anticipated. The Trojans made a run late in the second half. It was kind of a game of runs, went really back and forth. What do you attribute the Gators being able to pull away down the stretch? What do you attribute that to?
It's very similar if you look back to that Maryland-North Carolina game. I think that the damage was done in the first half. You know, Florida was leading USC 7-3 at the half. Much closer game in the second half. Florida only outscoring the Trojans 8-7. But I think just too much damage was done. When you dig yourself a deep hole against a team as talented as Maryland, as Florida, it's tough to get out of that hole. So I think that this was a great learning experience for USC, a team that ran undefeated through the regular season and didn't lose until the NCAA quarterfinals. They lost to a talented Florida team. I think, you know, once again, I can compare so many characteristics from those two games over the weekend. I think USC came out a little flat. I think it's easy to look flat against Florida. In my opinion, Florida is the fastest team in the country. So I think that USC, despite really, you know, continuing to dominate the draw controls, they beat Florida 17-10 on the draw circle, but they could not possess. The Florida defense was swarming them. Haley Hicklin had a big day for the Gators in goal. In my opinion, Haley Hicklin is one of the best goalies in college lacrosse. She had 13 saves. Conversely, Gussie Johns had 9 for USC. Hicklin, you know, I think the reason that she wasn't necessarily on a lot of these lists heading into the year, she split time as a freshman last year with Mary Shawn Wilcox. So now she's growing in her sophomore year. This is her defense. I think that, you know, with Hicklin, Fitzgerald, Bresnahan, Flanagan and Trombetta, this is the best defensive unit in the country. They really gave USC fits. You know, USC is a team, you know, you look at the way that that offense was attacking. They made adjustments in the second half. It was just a bit too late.
And Florida got great games out of their stars. Sammy Burgess and Molly Stevens both went for 5 points. Shayna Pareka and Sydney Pareka both went for 4. One of the notes that stands out is Lindsay Rombach was held scoreless. What were your thoughts on Florida's ability to get to 15 goals against a talented team, without getting more out of her?
You know, I think it was two things. Yeah, Lindsay Rombach certainly did have her looks. But I think it takes maturity as a player. She's a sophomore attacker, really one of the best attackers in the country, but it wasn't her day. As you mentioned, Molly Stevens really stormed out of the gate. You know, her season was cut a little short last year with injury. She comes back, she's shooting perfect 5 for 5. She had the hot hand. And, I think Rombach kind of pulled it out. You know, she was attracting a lot of pressure defensively, and she let her teammates go to work. I think you have the Pareka sisters, Rombeck, Stevens, Burgess, you mentioned. This is another, you know, as strong as their defense is, what makes this Florida team so dangerous is how deep and strong their offense is. If you could pinpoint one weakness on this Florida team, and I'm not even sure it's a weakness, but one thing that they have not been as successful as North Carolina and USC, two of the top teams they've faced thus far, they have struggled on the draw control.
And you mentioned that this is a new territory for USC, who went through the season undefeated last year. What do you think is next for the Women of Troy, and what do you think they need to do in order to regroup?
You know, I think that there's a lot of season left, and this is, you know, last year I remember talking to Coach Monday at the end of the season as the team was preparing for the NCAA tournament. And, you know, I asked her point blank, do you think it helps or hurts you that this team doesn't have a loss? And she was saying, you know, we've been in a lot of close games, so I don't think it hurts us. She's like, but now we have no choice. You know, we have to win out. So I think that when you are a team that hasn't lost a regular season game since 2015, you have this loss out of your way early. You can kind of breathe, you know, let your shoulders roll and just take it day by day moving forward. You know, when I look at the rest of their schedule, I'm very interested to see the Cornell game. Cornell gave Penn State a huge effort this weekend. I think Cornell's a lot more talented than people are giving them credit for. And then they clash with Stony Brook at the end of this month. And when you look into their April play, the bulk of their conference schedule, I really am excited to see that Colorado game. Colorado's now in the top 10 for the second week in a row. They beat Northwestern. Colorado came one goal shy of topping USC last year. So I think that there's, you know, certainly for USC's schedule, this Florida team is the strongest team on their schedule, but there's still a lot of strength and a lot of challenges remaining for this team to get up for and for this team to improve on.
Moving on, another significant top 20 matchup, Notre Dame Fighting Irish hand the Duke Blue Devils their first loss, 12-11 in an ACC debut. Molly Cobb leads the way, and Samantha Lynch lead the way for the Fighting Irish, putting up four goals apiece. This was a Duke team that was coming off of a win over Stanford in Texas, a really nice win for Notre Dame, who is now sits at 6-1. How good is Notre Dame, and how much of a bellwether is this game for answering that question?
You know, I think that Duke was leading in this game, leading at the half. In my opinion, the most impressive player on the field was Olivia Jenner. In addition to what she did on the draw control, she had a personal best 7 points. I think you look at Notre Dame and you can take two things away that really helped them win this game. Notre Dame is led by Courtney Fortunato. Courtney Fortunato was kept entirely off the scoreboard for this team. And typically, when teams pinpoint Fortunato to the point where she does not produce, Notre Dame has struggled annually. So you look at players like Molly Cobb, sophomore Samantha Lynch comes off the bench and scores four goals. I think that that's huge for Notre Dame. I think it's huge for their players because now they know they have the confidence. You know, if Courtney is held at bay, we can still do damage. We can still win games and win games against a very strong ACC opponent. And then conversely, it also tells, you know, the rest of the country that this is a team that can win games when Courtney Fortunato is really not involved all too much. So I think it's twofold. I think this win is huge for Notre Dame. It's players' confidence. You know, Molly Cobb, Samantha Lynch, and Savannah Buchanan, the two of them, they're relatively rookies in this. You know, Samantha Lynch did not see a lot of playing time last year. Savannah Buchanan is a true freshman. You know, you have a lot of youth on this Notre Dame team, so it's huge for their confidence. And it's also huge for teams and coaches that are going through their scout, and they have to look at players like Molly Cobb now. They have to look at Samantha Lynch. They have to deal with Nikki Ortega. So you look at that, I think this is a huge win for both sides of the ball for them.
Elsewhere in the top 20, Princeton, 17-10 victors over the Virginia Cavaliers. This is the Tigers' second win of the season, and certainly Olivia Hamp has led the way. What are your thoughts on how this game unfolded and the Tigers' ability to pull away from Virginia?
You know, definitely, I think it's interesting. I think this is one of those wins where you just kind of have to see how the rest of the season plays out. This is a Virginia team that has struggled against Elon, only beat Richmond by a goal. I think that they're really trying to find their identity. So you'll learn more about Princeton as the season continues, like what this win really meant. But I think that they are certainly a top 10 team. I've been voting them in the top 10 all season long, really in that 7-8 spot. They have the best goalie in college lacrosse on their team. Ellie DeGarmo has earned that right until somebody else outplays her. So far, no one has this season, although the season is very young. Olivia Hamp, a player that's able to do it all offensively. Colby Chanenchuk has really kind of evolved her game. She looks to be, she looks to be kind of that quarterback facilitator for this team. Tess Dorsey impressed as a freshman. She had 5 points. So I think that, you know, a lot of people last year thought that this was Olivia Hump's offense. You know, this team would only go as far as she could produce. with players emerging like Shannon Chuck, obviously Dorsey's arrival in Princeton, Allie Rogers now improving. I think this is a team that's a lot more balanced offensively than it's been in years past. And when you have the best goalie in college lacrosse on your team, that certainly doesn't help your defense either.
A game that you mentioned earlier in the podcast, Penn State 9, Cornell 8. Another top 20 matchup. This was obviously a hotly contested game, and certainly I think the expectation was that Penn State might be able to pull out a more dominant win than this performance. They were led by Steph Lazo, who had a goal and four assists. And what I'm just interested in the overall development of Penn State as they have, you know, been a Final Four program now and try to make the strides to become a Final Four contender consistently. But they turned over so much. And so as we continue to see them win these games against, you know, higher quality opponents, certainly, you know, a 20-9 win over Albany to begin the season and then a 13-11 win over Towson a week later were impressive. But, you know, it'd been 2 weeks since we'd seen a significant win out of the Nittany Lions. And now to be able to beat another top 20 opponent, it feels to me like this is the incremental progress of a good team who is figuring it out. They understand their standard as a program, and now they're going to continue to march in that direction. What's your take?
I agree. I completely agree with everything that you said. You look at the resume that this team has put together, a huge win over Albany, you know, despite the fact Albany was missing a couple of their key players for that game. I love the win over Towson. I love the win over Cornell. I think that Towson and Cornell are very underrated. You know, I don't think that Penn State falls with these margins. I think Cornell and Towson should continue to move up. You know, Cornell, I don't know what else Cornell needs to do to get the respect that they deserve. They won the Ivy League tournament last year. They got into the NCAA. I think that Cornell is continuing to take people by surprise, though I don't know how that's considered a surprise. I mean, I think that they were close. You know, they're playing this game in Ithaca on their home turf, and they were close to upsetting Penn State. You look at Penn State and why they were able to win this game. You know, Kat Renone did her part. She was 500 in goal, but Steph Lazo has been sensational for Penn State. She has matured into one of the country's top attackers this year. You look at kind of what this team has done through five games and who's gotten them there. Steph Lazo has 34 points, 18 goals, 16 assists. She is the only player on this team with double-digit assists, the only player with more than five to her name. So as a defense, I think teams are going to start keying in, if they can, on Lazo, whether they're going to start face guarding her. If I was certainly an opposing coach, I would throw a face guard on her. She is the catalyst to this offense. And look at her performance against Cornell. One goal, four assists. She was the only player on this Penn State team with an assist to her name. She was the playmaker. She won this game for Penn State.
Last one we're going to look back at from the weekend. It actually wasn't on the weekend. It was a rare and special Monday night lacrosse treat up from the Carrier Dome. The Syracuse Orange survived 13-12 against Albany. Riley Donahue ends it with a free position goal with 9.1 seconds remaining. But the story to me was Nicole Levy finished with six goals and went viral shortly after the game with a clip displaying her four free position shots that went to each corner of the net. An impressive performance. But not to be undersold is the way that Albany hung around in this game and continued to come after the Orange. So this is a game that I would imagine means a lot to you given your background. what was your takeaway and what do you think it says about each team heading forward?
Albany was back intact. They are a team that plays Syracuse very close as long as I can remember. You look at this team back in 2014, they had a two-goal loss to Syracuse. 2015, they had a two-goal loss to Syracuse. 2016, a one-goal loss to Syracuse. This is a team that just plays Syracuse very well. I think a lot of it has to do with when you look at this Albany roster, a lot of these girls are Syracuse, upstate, you know, central, western New York natives that for all intents and purposes, a lot of them probably weren't recruited by Syracuse. So they're coming into the Dome with a chip on their shoulder. They're playing in front of their hometown crowd. I think Albany always plays up to Syracuse in this game. And it's one of those games that I know that when you play and you're growing up, whether it's at high school, college level, there's always that one team, even if you're ranked a little bit ahead of them, or even if they're ranked a little ahead of you, rankings are thrown out the window when two teams go together, when there's such a rivalry there. And, you know, despite the fact that they are not in the same conference, these are the two upstate programs that do boast that rivalry. So I think that was just, you know, it's always fun. This is always a fun game. Nicole Levy, she is sensational. You know, she just has such a shot. What was really big in this game was the free positions. You know, I believe that Syracuse had almost 15 free positions. Albany had one. So Albany's defense was getting caught in shooting space a lot. Syracuse was able to capitalize on it. A free position is certainly not as easy as a free throw. But that's kind of what they've become. You know, at the end of every practice at Syracuse, we work on free positions. That's what we've always done. So these girls were ready. They were putting it away, especially Nicole Levy. If you give her that many opportunities from that short of a distance, she'll just snipe it right by you. She was a game changer in that game. But I think that this really showed that Albany can do a lot of damage, despite the fact that they have, you know, two losses to their names now. They're taking on North Carolina this weekend. They still have Cornell, Stony Brook left. I think this is a team that could push for NCAA tournament contention if they come out with some wins.
This is a philosophical question that you and I have never discussed. So there is a argument to be made that, for example, in basketball, you reference free throws. A team's ability to take a lot of free throws is a reflection of their ability to be aggressive, going to the basket, and get fouled. Do you feel similarly about shooting space in the way that it correlates with free positions, or do you think that it is one of those things that sometimes can be too subjectively evaluated by the officials?
Definitely too subjective evaluated by officials. I think that sometimes you see a lot of these shooting space calls and you're just like, no, she wasn't in shooting space, or she was marked up on her player. You know, you do credit the attacker though. I mean, Nicole Levy is a perfect example. Whenever she gets the ball, she takes a shot, look at goal, she takes a hitch. So I think the way that she attacks, the way that a lot of those Syracuse players kind of, the minute they do, they look to see what they can get really to draw that shooting space call. That was kind of, you know, I think key for them in this game. There are. I mean, as someone who used to get frustrated with the shooting space calls and the 3 seconds calls, you know, the rules in this game are so stacked up against defenders. Sometimes you just hate to see those calls, especially in a game that's so close, that's going back and forth. You almost, you know, want to let them play a little bit, but obviously shooting space is a safety rule first and foremost, so you don't want to let those shots fly and injure players. So I understand where the referees are coming from, trying to keep the game safe, especially in a game that was as hotly contested and physical as this game. But at the end of the day, you know, you do wish that you could have seen a little bit more free play out of these two teams, because the Syracuse offense is so talented. I wish that you got to see this offense work the ball a little bit better instead of just kind of putting the free positions away. But then again, at the end of the day, a goal is a goal.
Yeah, and I think that's, you know, to some degree, sports are never going to be immune. Sports that are officiated by humans are never going to be immune from subjectivity and trying to ensure that, you know, the rules are being equally and fairly applied to both ends. You know, and in rivalry games and in games where home field advantage plays a significant role and the crowd is in it and all that sort of thing, you know, those pivotal topics or those pivotal questions, you know, can become pivotal calls can become, you know, maybe out more significant than they are in games where, you know, the play on the field might be as even, but the circumstances surrounding the action isn't necessarily as hot. So just an interesting debate, certainly within, you know, obviously the world of women's lacrosse, which is undergoing a tremendous upheaval in terms of the way that, you know, the rules are written and applied, as well as, you know, the outsider's perspective on the nuances of what, you know, are very important rules. You mentioned, obviously, the safety components of them as well. So, Hallie, that was the weekend in college lacrosse. We are going to shift our focus now to look ahead to some Tuesday night news, and that being the unveiling of the Twarton Watch List. This was done at an event in New York City at which I was in attendance. And it was a really cool opportunity to hear from a handful of folks, board members that have affiliation with the Heisman Trophy. We heard from a member of the Seneca Nation who spoke about how significant so much with respect to the foundation and the scholarships that are provided offer. And then a handful of past winners were in attendance, including Rob Pinnell, Mike Lavelle, and Ned Crotty, in addition to a couple others. So just altogether a very good night. But more than that, it was the unveiling of 50 women who took one step forward toward winning the Twarton at the end of the season. You know, this is an opportunity to set the bar. There will be at least one, if not two, additional rounds or two rounds of additions for names to this list. And then on the heels of that, there will be two rounds of cutting down to 25 and then later to the five finalists who will be in attendance in Washington, D.C. the Thursday after the national championship game. At this point, I think that the list tends to favor those with whom we were familiar heading into the season, and meaning that, you know, if you're a freshman or if you're a player who hadn't had made significant contributions earlier in your career, it's the next two rounds of additions that are kind of for you. So that's just a little bit of a perspective setter. You know, that being said, a lot of great names on this list, and it's certainly a starting point for who we expect to be in contention to win. But I know that you want to talk about a couple of folks that didn't make it that you think need to be considered for the next round of additions.
Yeah, you know, I think that the Twarton, obviously, this committee did a great job. All 50 of these players are certainly deserving, and a lot of the front runners for this award, in my opinion, were in that grouping. Immediately, a few players left off. Penn's Britt Brown leaves the country in save percentage, 68%, leaves the country in saves per game, 15. So, you know, that save percentage is certainly not for lack of other teams trying to get the ball past her. And then she has one of the top scoring defenses in the country. I think that Ellie DeGarmo gets a lot of credit. She's the Princeton goalie. She's the national goalie of the year. But certainly there can be two goalies from one conference on the All-America lists. A lot of the time, they are Penn Princeton goalies. I mean, I think that Britt Brown was one of the surprising omissions on this list. And then Molly Stevens. You know, Molly Stevens is a player for Florida. When you look at how talented Florida is, they had five players on this list. You know, it could have been a volume issue here. You don't want to put too many players from one team, but she's leading this team in scoring right now. She has 12 points. She's leading this team in draw controls. She has 18. She's the only player with over 7 draw controls on this team. You know, Molly is definitely a senior leading Florida's charge right now. So I was a little surprised that she was left off. Certainly a lot of time for her to be added on. But when you look at this Florida team as a whole, you know, really two of the three players that I think has been their driving force so far this season, Haley Hicklin, their sophomore goalkeeper, and Molly Stevens left off this initial list. So that was a little surprising. I think definitely those three players, should they continue to play the way they've been playing, will be on the first round of additions.
It's certainly a I think one of the things that's most helpful about this moment, this part of the process, like I said, it's a way to set expectations, and ultimately it's a way for the committee to gauge reaction as to who around the lacrosse community that isn't actively involved in the process thinks deserves to be. It's kind of like crowdsourcing your candidate identification. And so feedback like that, I think, is essential to making sure that, you know, the focus is properly looked at when it comes to, you know, additional considerations. You know, I think a couple of the points you brought up, they don't really sit that well with me. The idea of having, you know, multiple players from multiple positions in the same conference, you can do that and they can be in the final five. You know what I mean? If the idea and the award is to award it to the best player in the country, then it's entirely possible that two players from the same position in the same conference could be the two best players in the country. Yeah. And need to be discerned between. And then to the point about kind of, I don't know if vote stealing is the right word, but distribution of acknowledgement across one roster. Yeah, I think that's a little bit more realistic with respect to the role that we know coaches play in advocating for their own players throughout this process, or the degree to which they choose to or not choose to. And so certainly an interesting question to look at going forward, and obviously very valuable for you to bring that to the forefront.
Absolutely. I just, you know, I do agree. I think that the point you bring up about two positional players, you see it happen with midfield and certainly attack all the time. Last year was the first year that I can remember two women's finalists being defenders. This year, you know, I think that this is a very goalie rich year. You know, if players like, let's say, Kaylee Waters and Ellie DeGarmo continue to have record-breaking years at their position, why can't the two of them be finalists together? You know, I think that goalie, I mean, can you remember a year that there were two men's goalie finalists? I don't think it's ever happened before.
It has not happened, no. And to my knowledge, there have only been two goalie finalists over the course of the entire history of the award, those being Trevor Tierney and John Galloway.
Let's just get some love for the goalies this year.
Hey, you're not going to hear an argument out of me on that one. All right, Hallie. Well, one of the other big news items for the week is, as was mentioned at the top, we have a new number one in the Cascade Women's Media Poll. The Maryland Terrapins are 3-0 coming off of a win over North Carolina. Prior to that, they had wins over Georgetown and William & Mary. You know, they've taken care of business to this point. They certainly have the lineage and the track record. The question now is, how long are they going to run the table for? They travel to Hofstra on Saturday, and then a week from today, host Boston College in yet another ACC showdown. This is they're gonna challenge for the ACC title despite the fact they're not even in the league anymore. they turn around and host Syracuse a week from Saturday, and then it's a rivalry game against Johns Hopkins. So you know, certainly an upcoming schedule dotted with top 20 opponents, but not necessarily as daunting as other stretches in their schedule going forward. So if I were betting, I would say that the Terps are going to be number one, at least through St. Patrick's Day. Do you see any pitfalls or speed bumps on their path between now and, say, March 29th when they host Florida?
You know, it's interesting. I think that, I mean, just if history tells us anything about Maryland, this team just doesn't really lose. They've lost three times in the last 3 years, and two of those games came at the hands of North Carolina, a team that they just beat. So if history repeats itself, you know, in the last 3 years, the only team on this latter half of their schedule to come out with a win has been Ohio State. So, you know, Syracuse, Johns Hopkins, certainly I think JMU is not getting the credit it deserves. I think JMU is a very talented team. Obviously Florida, you know, you look at, you know, Ohio State, Penn State, Northwestern, right before they play Princeton, before they go into that Big Ten stretch. They have the best of the rest beyond North Carolina left on their schedule. So of course there's room for this team to lose and to give away that number one spot. But to be honest, I'm not sure if any team will be able to beat Maryland. I mean, that's just the way that they do things down there. They have rebuilt this team in the wake of Taylor Cummings very well. And I think what Maryland did on Saturday, you know, they come out of the 2017 gate with wins over William & Mary and Georgetown. But their win on Saturday was a statement game. A lot of people thought Maryland might be down this year, you know, might be down, but they're still the number two team in the country because they were so young, but their youth showed that they're more than capable to continue to carry on the torch. Yeah, certainly, you know, for the sake of the game and for the sake of, you know, continued parity, you know, I do hope that some of these teams can put together their best game against Maryland. I'm just not sure that they can.
Turning our attention ahead, we don't have two matchups in the top four like we did last week. That being said, in the way that this was last week was a monumental week for women's lacrosse across the board, we've got a really big weekend ahead for the Syracuse Orange. They take on Northwestern in the Dome on Friday, and then they turn around as part of a doubleheader and take on the Virginia Cavaliers at 4 p.m. on Sunday. Gary Gate has not been shy about scheduling. I mean, this is a man that's scheduled two games in one day. What do you think of this back-to-back, and what do you think you're going to learn about the Orange this weekend?
Well, you know, first and foremost, the Friday game, although Syracuse is the home team, they're actually traveling to Long Island for this game. They were playing in Hempstead. So kind of a homecoming. You know, if you look at the Syracuse roster, you look at the Northwestern roster, huge Long Island contingents on both rosters. So Northwestern and Syracuse travel down to take on each other, a homecoming for a lot of their players. That's going to be a huge game. As I've mentioned before, you know, Northwestern was quiet over the last, you know, week or so, but I think Northwestern is one of the best teams in the country. Two overtime goals separate them from being where they are now and probably being the number two, three, four team in the country. And I think that Syracuse is young. You know, Syracuse pulled a huge win out over Albany. You saw leadership in players like Riley Donahue and Nicole Levy. You know, they have wins over Massachusetts. They have wins over Boston College. Up until that Albany game, they had not been challenged. So this is going to be a weekend of a lot of challenges. You know, Northwestern is going to throw everything they can at Syracuse. And then Virginia, whereas they are not in the top 20, the talent is there. The talent is traveling up from Charlottesville. This is going to be no cakewalk for Syracuse. You know, two of the toughest, probably two of the toughest, if not, you know, the two toughest teams that they've faced this weekend. They're playing, you know, 48 hours apart, and there's a road trip down to Long Island involved in this. And then you look, you know, past the Northwestern and Virginia, these two games will tee up the Orange for Maryland and Florida in the following weeks. So, you know, it'll be huge for Syracuse. Can they make it out of this weekend 7-0, you know, 6-1 or 5-2? I think that that's going to be huge. So far this season, what's really impressed me about Syracuse has been the next generation, has been the youth. Morgan Widener, a Texas native, comes in her freshman year and she's leading the country in draw controls per game. And then you look at players like Nicole Levy, who, you know, she's stepping up. She's the veteran of this attack, and she's a sophomore. Riley Donahue has really continued to impress and evolve her game. You know, I think heading into the season, a lot of people had Nicole Levy pegged as the leader of this offense. Riley Donahue is actually the quarterback of this offense. And then you look at players like Emily Harris-Chuck. She's coming in off the bench, a freshman. Asa Goldstock's a freshman starting in goal, a very young team. And I think that this freshman sophomore class's ability to step up and really step up big has been the kind of just continuing factor that Syracuse remains a top four or five team with such huge graduations loss last year.
So why didn't we have Ashley McCullough on this week so that you guys could shout about Virginia Syracuse?
Probably would have been a good idea. I don't think I had the foresight, but it's been a busy week. I don't know if I wanted to get in an argument to kick off my Wednesday.
Yeah, I think maybe we can hold off on that for next week and talk about things that happened as opposed to speculate on things that might.
That's a good idea. Ashley, you're available for post game next week?
Exactly. And then looking around the rest of the landscape, a couple of games have already been mentioned in terms of the big ones that dot the schedule. To keep your eye on, Duke versus Virginia Tech, Notre Dame versus Louisville. Loyola versus Penn State is one insofar as the Greyhounds need a signature win, and that would certainly represent that.
Yeah, you know, Loyola, definitely a team. They come out of the gate. They started their season a little bit later than the rest of the country, probably just Coach Adams wanting to keep her team fresh. They start with two disappointing losses at the hands of local rivals. You know, the Hopkins game was certainly a very close one. Towson seemed to have Loyola's number for the bulk of that game. But Loyola is one of those teams, you know, they are going to, every year, I feel like they come up with one to two, like, huge upset wins that keep them in the top 15 conversation. And this year they haven't gotten that. So I think, you know, throughout the rest of the year, Loyola is definitely on that upset alert. Not just this weekend, but I think moving right past the rest of their non-conference schedule into Patriot League play.
Speaking of upset alert, Albany takes on North Carolina on Friday. This is a Great Danes team that went toe-to-toe with Syracuse. We talked about how the rivalry factor maybe fed into their ability to, you know, swing a little bit above a level that they had prior in the season. Is there any way that they can, you know, catch a disappointed Carolina team coming off of this loss against Maryland?
I think there definitely is. I think Sarah Martin, Albany midfielder, she's one of the best midfielders in the country. I just love the heart and kind of hustle that she exemplifies when she attacks every facet of her game. I think it's going to be interesting. You know, North Carolina, if I know Jenny Levy the way I know her and Phil Barnes and the staff down in Chapel Hill, the minute they left College Park, this team was preparing for the road ahead and really getting back and working on the little things they didn't do well. So Albany is probably taking on North Carolina at the most inopportune time they probably could, coming off of their, you know, first loss since early last season, and a team that didn't play their best game against Maryland, which I'm sure they took very personally as they were taking the field in practice this week. I think Albany's definitely a team that could challenge them. They would need to put a perfect game together to take home a W over the Tar Heels.
Another interesting one on Friday, Denver versus Colorado. Battle for the Sunshine State. Gorgeous.
Battle, best of the West. You know, again, these are two teams that have both jumped in the polls. I mean, if you look at what the preseason poll looked like and you look at this poll now, you know, Towson's a mainstay in the poll. James Madison's in there. Colorado's in the top 10. Denver's in the top 20. So it looks very different. Denver and Colorado, I think no matter where this game goes, both of those teams remain in the top 20. But obviously, conversely, just another quality win on Denver's resume should they beat Colorado and vice versa. I think both have proven that they are top 20 teams this year. So I think they both should remain, but continue to see, you know, which team continues to move up. Obviously, a lot more on the line for Colorado now than Denver. Denver has a lot more room to move up with this game. But yeah, definitely two teams that I'm excited to see how their season goes on. I'm really excited to see how Denver's season continues once their Big East play begins.
And then on Sunday, rounding out the weekend, a couple of interesting matchups, Northwestern Stony Brook. And then one that I think might fly a little bit under the radar is Towson versus Florida. You know, the Tigers have made some waves early in the season, and similar, not the same, but similar to Loyola in the sense that this is an opportunity to make a statement. What do you think of the Tigers and how they're positioned against the Gators?
I think the Tigers are positioned well against the Gators. You know, I think that this game is going to come down to, as they so often do, draw controls. You know, how can both of these teams do on the draw? I think the struggle, if you don't beat Florida on the draw, is that this is a Florida team that just foot speed alone can run all over you. Foot speed alone, and then the way that they play in the shot clock era, because you talked to Mandy O'Leary and she said, you know, in years past when we've tried to slow our offense down, we actually don't play well. So our girls run and gun. That's kind of how we play. That's how we play well. So you look at the way that Florida can play. I think Towson, a key to this game, is going to be getting the ball off the draw and then slowing this game significantly down on the defensive end, which Towson can do. I mean, they have such a strong defense. They were one of the top defenses in the country last year, one of the top defenses again in the country, especially with the zone defensive set that they'll throw at you. They'll try to take away Florida's first look. But the problem with that is that Florida has so many looks. They move the ball so well. So I think that key to this game, Towson off the draw, and for Florida, just not allowing themselves to be slowed down offensively and just really looking for that second look and moving the ball a few times before you move it in. And that's when a player like Molly Stevens, you know, I keep going back to her this week, that's where she kills you. She is a zone killer because she is so good in the middle of the field. You know, getting open is not that easy. It takes a talented player to get open. And when you have players like Sammy Burchess and Lindsay Ronbeck, who can get the ball into you so well, you know, Molly Stevens is that inside zone look when slides come. And she's just so good at getting herself open, getting her stick up, and putting the ball past goalies. So I think that that's the key to this game. Florida just needs to continue what they've been doing against a very talented zone defense.
Hallie Quillinen, that will do it for week 4 of the Isle Women podcast. We thank you so much for your time. Your insight, as always, was awesome. And you heard it. We got a couple of folks on Upset Alert this weekend.
Thanks so much. And as always, if you guys have anything that you want to hear us chat about aimlessly for over an hour every week, certainly let us know. Terry and I are on Twitter and looking forward to your comments. Isle Women Podcast, the source of her sport.